We'll call this meeting of the State Government Finance Committee to order. We have a quorum. Representative Hertas, did you get a chance to look at the minutes? Representative Hertas moves the minutes of March 6th, 2019 to be approved. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motions are approved. There you go. And members, today we have, oh, there's my agenda. We have the management and budget here to explain their overview of their budget change level recommendations. Easy for me to say. Welcome to the committee. Please.
Actually, they're doing their overview as well.
Okay, and their overview too. So, introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony. Uh-oh, forgot something. And you don't want that to go off while you're...
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question, please?
Representative Claiborne.
I'm just asking about the tab that we're using. Are we using management and budget, or are we using management and budget non-operating? Or will we do both?
Both.
Thank
Probably
you.
Both, yeah.
But mostly management.
Mostly, mostly management and budget.
Thank you.
I believe the other one is I was told that there's is stuff that was given to them is because no place else to put it in the budget. So that's kind of what's the catch-all for other different places. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Hallstrom, Deputy Commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to be with you today to talk about the work that Minnesota Management and Budget does for the state of Minnesota and a little bit about our governor's recommended change items. Minnesota Management and Budget is one of a handful of agencies that has as its primary responsibility helping to deliver Minnesotans the government that they want and deserve: effective, transparent, fair, innovative, and striving to improve. Our mission is to serve the people of Minnesota by providing leadership and guidance to state agencies to support efficient and effective government, a world-class workforce, and strong and responsible financial management. In 2008, the Department of Finance and Department of Employee Relations were combined to form what we know now today as the Department of Management and Budget. The structure makes sense because financial and human resources go hand in hand when it comes to delivering effective services by the government. In order to meet Minnesotans' high expectations in that regard, we work to support employees that will deliver those services and provide the resources necessary to do their jobs well. M&B has approximately 260 employees, an annual general fund of operating budget of approximately $26 million. We're responsible for executing or involved with somewhere around 1,800 statutory responsibilities. We coordinate the budget process for over 100 state agencies, boards, and commissions. We maintain human resources policy, including recruitment, retention, talent management, and training. We manage $8 billion in public debt, pay vendors, supply goods and services to the public, process state employee payroll, administer the state employee health insurance program, produce budget forecasts, which you're familiar with, negotiate contracts with our 9 bargaining units, and that just names a few of the higher profile responsibilities that we have. We also maintain 8 critical information technology systems that help power the state's business. Those are the Statewide Integrated Financial Management Tools, SWIFT, that's our state accounting system. We operate the Budget Planning Analysis System, BPAS, which many of you are familiar with, the Capital Budget System, our Fiscal Note Tracking System, our Human Resources System, which is known as SEMAFORE, that's the State Employee Management Application, Job Application System, known as Recruiting Solutions, the Enterprise Learning Management System, and our data warehouse, known as it's an Oracle Business Intelligence system. And I'd also like to highlight, if I could at the outset, just a couple of the aspects of our work that can sometimes go unnoticed but reflect significant contributions by the team at MMB. We've helped manage a smooth transition between administrations in November through January, and that is quite a lot of work. There's a lot of transition and a lot of things to keep the trains running through that process, including building budget. At the same time, we're coordinating and planning among all agencies the impacts of the federal shutdown. At the time that we began that work, it was a potential federal shutdown, and we are practiced in preparing for that, but it turned into one of the longest federal shutdowns in history. And in fact, I think 35 days was the longest federal shutdown in history. And finally, we play an important role in the previous administration, providing, you know, strong financial and human resources management practices to improve overall government operation, and we continue to do that work in the new administration to help the governor and lieutenant governor carry forward their vision for One Minnesota. So let me talk just a little bit about the MMB structure. We are organized into six divisions: the accounting division, budget division, debt management division, enterprise human capital, enterprise communications and planning, and agency administration. And I'll give you just a brief summary of what each of those divisions handle. The accounting services division is the foundation that supports the state's financial operation. We provide the statutorily required infrastructure for efficient and effective accounting and payroll services conducted throughout the state. Our primary customers are state agencies, as well as the individuals and organizations that do business with the state, our vendors. The division operates through three sections: the state payroll services, statewide accounting, and then the SWIFT system support. And all three of those sections establish and maintain financial policies and procedures designed to safeguard the assets and ensure compliance with legal requirements. They also provide advice, consultation, and technical assistance to agencies regarding financial management practices. The budget team provides comprehensive budget assistance, guidance, instructions, monitoring, and implementation, and financial oversight to the state's agencies. The work of the budget division is to create and share objective, relevant information and tools for decision makers to coordinate, communicate, and communicate fiscal policy statewide. The staff develops and coordinates the governor's operating and capital budget proposals, as well as provide support to the legislative budget process. We maintain and publish fund statements. That's the state's bottom line for the general fund and all of our other funds. And the budget division works closely with accounting services and debt management to monitor agency spending to ensure that it's consistent with legislative decisions. And then our nationally recognized Results First program, which derives decision making based on results research, is an integral part of the budget division, and I'll talk a little bit about the results team when we get to our change item proposals. State's debt management team is responsible for overseeing approximately $8 billion worth of public debt, as I mentioned. The staff plans and executes bond sales to fund capital investment projects passed by the legislature, and they're also responsible for oversight of our other legislative mandates relating to the issuance and distribution of bond proceeds. The state currently holds bond ratings of AAA with Standard & Poor's, AAA with Fitch, and we have an AA1 with Moody's, which is their highest non-AAA rating, and our hope is to bring that up to AAA and get us back to where we were a decade ago. Enterprise Human Capital, I'll talk a little bit about the work that they do. While most agencies, boards, and commissions have some of their own human resources support, MMB's human capital team is responsible for providing guidance and direction with respect to all of the state's employee relations work that's supporting our mission to provide effective public services by recruiting, retaining, and developing qualified and highly motivated employees. Our ultimate goal is for the state to be an employer of choice and attract the best workers to state employment. The Enterprise Human Capital Division is organized into a labor relations unit, enterprise learning and development, recruiting and retention, compensation and classification. We administer the State Employee Group Insurance Program, CGIP, which you're probably familiar with, and then we have a research policies and projects team to guide the development of policy statewide. That team manages three statewide systems that I mentioned earlier to focus on the employee relations work that they do. And then, as I mentioned, the labor relations team negotiates nine contracts with state employee bargaining units. I think it's worth mentioning the state employee insurance program is the largest self-insured pool, providing health benefits to 129,000 or thereabouts employees, dependents, and retirees annually in all three branches of government, the Minnesota State University System, and many of our quasi-government agencies as well. The Enterprise Communications and Planning Division works to ensure employees and agencies, state leaders, stakeholders, have the tools and information they need to effectively do their work. Members of the team focus on proactive and inclusive planning strategies to create a culture of collaboration, communication, and information sharing throughout the agency and the enterprise. This is important given MMB's responsibilities and interactions with a wide variety of state government entities. The division is made up of five units, all of which play key roles in helping the agencies provide those services. The Internal Control and Accountability Unit exists under law to design, implement, and maintain effective internal controls in the executive branch. We have a Business Continuity Unit that provides leadership, guidance, and coordination to ensure the executive branch can respond to disasters quickly and resume priority services, minimize loss, repair damage, and replace equipment or facilities in a timely and effective manner. This is the group that's primarily responsible for preparing for contingencies like government shutdown, as I talked about earlier. Our communications unit is responsible for collaborating with state agencies and proactively communicating key initiatives and information. They manage our website, data requests, media inquiries, social media publications, internal communications, outreach events, and the like. And our enterprise resource planning unit collaborates closely with our business information technology staff. The IT systems that I mentioned earlier are the heart of what allow us to do our daily work and provide services critical to Minnesotans. And those systems are really shared systems, and so we have a governance structure designed to ensure that they are meeting the needs of our customers. And then finally, the Management Analysis and Development section, known as MAD, exists under law to support the commissioner's requirement to provide analytical, statistical, and organizational development services to state agencies and other public entities in the state. It's a team of 19. They receive no general fund support. They're a fee-for-service management consulting group, though their rates are much preferable to and more competitive than the private sector. Because MAD's in-house, they also know state government and have been doing the work that they do to help us provide more effective services since 1985. And finally, the agency administrative staff provides a variety of function. This is essentially our internal management division. We are designed primarily to serve the employees at MMB. And we have administrative and fiscal services, agency human resources, strategic planning, and our agency administrative statutory responsibilities around producing mandated reports, the budget and economic forecast, delivery of the budget documents. And the administrative team, I should note, was responsible for successfully executing the premium insurance subsidy program that the legislature passed and created in 2017. So with that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, let me move on to our change items that you should have before you. As I mentioned, our mission is to serve the people of Minnesota by providing leadership and guidance to provide effective and efficient services, and these change items are relate to those core functions and are proposed to maintain and enhance the delivery of our statutory responsibilities, which we take very seriously. So starting with our investments in the state workforce, the government is recommending $3.766 million in FY20 and then $3.185 million in fiscal year 21 and thereafter to support MMB's efforts to attract, hire, and retain support and support the best workforce, which is responsible for delivering services to Minnesotans. The recommendation supports enhanced sexual harassment prevention activities, an Office of Inclusion and Equity, to state workforce recruitment activities, and a statewide compensation study. And I'll go through those with a little bit more detail right now. The state of Minnesota agencies, boards, and commissions compete for top talent in a tightening labor market and an aging demographic. And as a result, we need to be innovative in our employment and recruitment practices. With unemployment below 3%, the job market is extremely competitive, and it's increasingly difficult to attract and retain the workforce that we need to maintain the services that Minnesotans depend on, especially in certain job classifications. So the executive branch has been losing about 1,000 employees to retirement annually since fiscal year 2013, and those turnover can be disruptive and expensive. We have seen estimates that say it can be as much as 100% of an annual salary to replace a longstanding employee. So in order to ensure wages are in line with the public and private sector, we are proposing a one-time compensation study to update our information on the current marketplace. We're also asking for reliable and ongoing funding to support our recruiting and retention activities in the Enterprise Human Resources Unit. We have an obligation to keep our employees safe and prevent harassment of any kind. And the proposal would create a centralized office that would investigate workplace sexual harassment claims as well as help deliver enhanced sexual harassment prevention efforts. We conducted a statewide or a system-wide executive branch-wide report on harassment in the state's workforce and provided recommendations for best practices to effectively prevent and respond to sexual harassment in the workplace. And that report concluded that that a centralized office where claims could be processed in a consistent manner would be an effective tool in eliminating harassment in the workplace. And a reliable appropriation from the general fund would be the most efficient and effective way to do that to achieve consistent results across the enterprise. We also, to support the administration's goal of a government that works for everyone, Governor Walz is requesting $390,000 to create an Office of Inclusion and Equity to lead the development and implementation of proactive diversity, inclusion, and equity programs. This would be two full-time employees, including a state chief inclusion officer housed at MMB, to provide strategic guidance, comprehensive analysis, and coordinated direction across the enterprise. We'd be focusing on meeting the expectations Minnesotans have for inclusive government. And this office would coordinate agency engagement activities, advise the governor's office and commissioners, drive outreach efforts, and lead the Diversity and Inclusion and Equity Council, created by Executive Order 1901, the first executive order from this administration. This office will play a critical role in addressing the governor's One Minnesota goal to reduce disparities related to race, ethnicity, geography, gender, and the like. Turning to the next change item, investing in our statewide systems, the governor is recommending $5.7 million in one-time funding for FY20 from the general fund to Minnesota's management and budget for its systems. And of this amount, $2 million is to address the cost of maintenance upgrades to MMB-operated enterprise systems that I talked about before. These upgrades are important and represent essentially the new baseline with our primary vendor, Oracle, to take on future patches and upgrades as they release those and to ensure that their systems are secure and accessible to all. We are asking for $3.2 million to replace out-of-support hardware and purchase disaster recovery hardware, and then another $500,000 to conduct a study of our enterprise systems, the results of which would be used to develop a sustainable long-term funding plan as recommended by the Office of the Legislative Auditor in their report last year. As I mentioned earlier, our enterprise systems are used by all state agencies to manage state day-to-day business, and without those systems, agencies are impeded in their ability to deliver their services. Indeed, I note that we are in the process of transitioning, I think, Senate staff to our state payroll system as it provides a more efficient and cost-effective way to provide these services to staff in other branches of government, not just the executive branch. And then I want to take a couple out of order. I know that I think the next up is our operating budget ask. I'm going to put that at the end, if you don't mind, so I can talk about the operating budgets a little bit more collectively. We have two requests relating to our results analysis management team. I'll speak to the first one, which is just enhancing the results analysis for decision making. As I alluded to earlier, the results management unit in the budget division is tasked with collecting research and providing analysis on programs.
Page 18.
Tracking progress related to outcomes for the people of Minnesota. They use rigorous research, local experience and expertise, and data to give policymakers valuable information about making decisions. So in short, their job is to inform you and the governor which services are effective, which are supported by data to allow you to make the best decision about how to allocate our limited resources. We're proud to report this unit has received national recognition for their efforts, and other states are patterning their work and similar programs on Minnesota's work. In 2013, the legislature passed a law that provided resources to implement the Pew MacArthur Foundation's Results First initiative, And through that initiative, our results team has analyzed the effectiveness of nearly 500 public policy programs, from children's mental health to recidivism programs at the Department of Corrections. So the governor and lieutenant governor are proposing to expand the work of the results management team so that we can provide even more data-driven information to better inform that policymaking process. And the request is for $250,000 in the first year and slightly more each year thereafter to expand the work of that unit by about 2.5 full-time employees. The request funds additional capacity to collect and analyze new data, collaborate with the producers of useful data to give policymakers access and comprehensive information. And just in summary, the work is about status of key outcomes for Minnesotans, the effectiveness of current policies and procedures, opportunities for improvement, and opportunities to enhance collaboration with our partners, both public and non-governmental partners. So legislators have access to many sources of information, and despite that wealth of information, sometimes it is challenging to know if a particular policy goal is being achieved, and so that is really what the goal of the Results First team is. And then the second piece of that request relates to the evaluation of the opioid stewardship investments. And so we propose that the state rigorously evaluate the impact of publicly funded interventions to prevent and treat opioid addiction as part of the comprehensive opioid proposal making its way through the legislature, and a special acknowledgement to the work of Representative Olson and Representative Baker to continue moving the opioid stewardship program through the legislature. Our funding request would begin in fiscal year 21 and thereafter, and would fund five full-time employee equivalents to do the following. We would do 2 to 4 program evaluations per year. We coordinate with policymakers and community representatives to select those projects. We consult with stakeholders, gather input, and establish expectations. We do evaluation design, identify indicators, collect data, and evaluate that data, and then brief stakeholders on the findings and facilitate findings for policymakers and practitioners at the local level as well. These evaluations produce findings that indicate the extent to which there's causal evidence between the studied interventions to prevent opioid abuse and emergency room visits and other important outcomes such as employment and earnings, housing stability, and involvement in the criminal justice system. So with that, let me turn to the operating adjustments for MMB, and then I'll speak a little bit more generally about the approach that the budget process took in identifying what agencies need in this regard. We're requesting $929,000 at MMB over the biennium to maintain our current service levels. Specifically to MMB, we anticipate increases in retirements, an increase in the agency's lease, and contractual increases to our regular payroll that we can predict. So as I had mentioned, we're just to give a little bit of an explanation of the broader approach we took to developing operating budget requests from agencies. Each year, the cost of doing business rises. Employer-paid health care contributions, FICA, Medicare, along with salary and compensation-related costs increase. Other operating costs like rent, lease, fuel, utilities, information technology, and legal services, those also grow. And then this cost growth puts pressure on agency budgets, which remain flat in the base year to year. So while departments continually seek to find opportunities to become more efficient within their existing resources and their base appropriation, those amounts assume no inflationary increases. And so efficiencies alone are not adequate to always maintain or offset the need for operating appropriation increases to maintain those current services. Therefore, in the governor's 2021 budget process, agencies were asked to evaluate their unique cost pressures affecting their agencies. This is the same guidance that we're going to boards, commissions, and others, particularly those in front of this committee, to identify what their particular needs are moving forward. The document, I think, in your packet, just is for illustrative purposes. It is not a budget document, but it attempts to show how each agency has different cost pressures, ranging from some agencies may find that retirements are going to be the place where they're going to see particular cost pressures. Other agencies are seeing increases in their volume of IT services or increase in the cost for those services. Lease can be a pretty wide-ranging cost driver depending on where you're located, whether you're located in admin or on the campus or admin-controlled facilities or operating with a private lessor. And then we have a wide variety of complements of staffing at our agencies. So some agencies have overall younger trend. Some agencies have an overall older trend. That makes a difference for known cost increases for around employment. So we talk about steps, things that you know you can predict if your employment complement stays the same, that those costs will increase according to some schedule. Our semaphore application allows agencies to kind of model that looking out into the future. And so what agencies have presented you, and I believe we might be the last agency to go, so you may have already heard from the agencies on the list, the boards and commissions, but each of them were identifying those particular needs that they have to maintain their base level of service. And so, as I said, from the MMB perspective, one of those big drivers for us is anticipated retirements and lease. We don't see as much coming in the IT cost increases, so you just see a variation between agencies. There's no formula that agencies applied to make these proposals. They really are designed to tailor only to what they anticipate their needs to be. So with that, I'm proud to be part of the MMB team, and I'm proud to be in front of you today. The positive impact our small agency has on the state is large. Our headcount's about the same as it was in 2010, and we continue to take on more responsibilities. Proud of the work that we do to accomplish that, and I'm proud of the employees that I work with at MMB, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Well, thank you, Mr. Hallstrom. I guess the first question I have when I'm looking at this, when I first looked at this spreadsheet here, the retirement cost. Now, what is that? That's not the increase in what we're paying into the pension. What was in the retirement cost section? Because I see some agencies have it and some of them don't, or some of the groups here have it.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The retirement cost is not something that we can predict with the level of precision that we can predict with like steps for an employment plan. But if you look at the overall age and kind of trend of your workforce, we're nearing the end of those individuals who can retire at through something called the Rule of 90, which I won't attempt to explain in great detail. But it is really a process where we've looked at our agency demographics, our anticipated retirements, and then when you retire, there's certain payouts that are available depending on whether you're under a pay plan or one of the collective bargaining agreements. And so we try to anticipate what we are going to see in personnel cost payments that aren't tied to somebody's regular salary, but are in fact for that payout. Yeah.
So, Mr. Holston, that'd be like severance
yeah.
costs or whatever, payout of vacation pay, payout of.
Yeah. There's a methodology that some portion of your sick and vacation pay becomes part of that package when you retire.
Thank you. Another question I have is, in past years we've had a lot of discussion. There was a gain sharing program that was started, and it's caused some of the department, I understand, some problems with how to institute it. And I was guessing the question I have is, do you have ideas how we can work together to try and come up with the language to make the program actually work better so that we can actually make the program, I guess, work?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's a good question. I testified before this committee about a year ago. We talked pretty in depth about what MMB saw as some of the challenges with the program. I think the legislative auditor looked at some of the work that had been done prior to the law change in 2017, and then the work that we've done since then. We've submitted some additional information to the committee, kind of following up on those hearings. I would say that there hasn't been a lot of movements from since a year ago, but we have been in conversation with and in trying to engage with legislators that for which this is a priority. We have some what we think good ideas to help improve the change legislative language and provide some adjustments, I think, to achieve the goals. We shared in broad strokes the goals of the gain sharing program, and it is reflected in the work we've done around achievement awards and others. Motivate your employees to find those efficiencies, find those savings, and so we remain committed to working with anybody who is interested in kind of finding the optimal mix of that legislative requirement and then policy development on our end. And I think I have a bunch of materials on my desk that have some suggested language changes too. So we are happy to work with anybody who is interested and happy to have additional conversation about it. We think it's doable.
Well, thank you. I look forward to getting that language just so we can try and include it in our budget as we put our budget forward. It's good to have. If we're going to have a program, we want to make sure it works so that we get the benefits out of it that's anticipated. I have one more question, and it had to do with preparing for the shutdown and then the shutdown and recovering from it. Where are we at it and the recovery from the shutdown? I mean, are we fully back to getting payments from the federal government and everything back working the way it's supposed to, or are we still some IRPs in the process?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say at a broad and high level, we are back to normal. The fact that we were able to achieve a full year of funding from the federal government through the end of their fiscal year was helpful. We've shifted from moving from continuing resolution to continuing resolution. That created a lot of challenges both for our federal partners who sometimes didn't have the necessary information to answer the questions that the state agencies had about what they can expect, and sometimes you didn't get that information until the very last minute. But largely, as I think Commissioner Franz had testified, and I'm not sure here, but certainly elsewhere, a lot of the challenges around the federal shutdown related to timing, because many of the federal funding streams are on different calendars. And so what does a February 15th shutdown date mean for your March 1 reimbursements? So a fairly complicated exercise that then required us to bring to the legislature information we had about where we anticipated a lack of reimbursement, a lack of funding, so we could make the right decision about what risks to take in terms of funding federal activities if there was a question mark about what we thought the long-term reimbursement was going to be. We feel pretty good about where we're at right now, but this is a cycle, and I expect that we will be preparing for the possibility of similar activity as we get into the fall.
Unfortunately. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In reading the legislative auditor's report on MNIT, there was extensive discussion over the kind of sporadic nature of the funding that MMB and MNIT have received related to the systems that are owned by MMB, and complaints also about the perceived lack of transparency in the chargeback structures. I'm seeing evidence that you guys are taking that seriously and working in the right direction. Specifically with respect to the various products in the Oracle PeopleSoft suite, it would be customary in the private sector with a platform like this for the cost of upgrades, at least for the software part itself, to be included in an annual maintenance fee for Oracle is probably typically around 15% of the purchase price. Are we paying ongoing license and maintenance that and it provides us access to all of the upgrades, or is the absence of consistent funding preventing us from budgeting for just routine ongoing maintenance of these systems?
Mr. Hallstrom.
Mr. Chair, representatives, I think the answer is yes to both. Part of our problem, to the extent that we find a challenge, is that the SWIFT system was launched in 2011 after a pretty big build-out, mm-hmm. and then there wasn't a lot of maintenance, dedicated maintenance resources available then. So it had sat in that without kind of those initial upgrades happening in 2012, 2013, 2014, which is sometimes okay, but what Oracle has really changed the way that they deliver their upgrades and their patches. And so if you haven't gotten your system up to a basic level, we're running out of time where we can actually take their upgrades. And so that means if they have an updated cybersecurity patch or a fix, if we're not at a certain level in our system, we're not going to be able to take those patches. And they deliver them in a way where they send us basically a file, and we can go through and pick the pieces of that we want to apply to our system. But we have gotten to a point where we need to get ourselves back up to that base threshold level so that we can continue to take those. We do pay for a lot of Oracle maintenance and support. But at some point, Oracle tells us that all the support in the world won't help you if your system's not up here. They can assign us.
They'll tell you if you're not at least at this release, we're not supporting you anymore.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. So it's sort of like putting the $10,000 stereo in the 20-year-old car.
Yeah. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Well, my point, Mr. Chair, is that things would work a lot better if we were providing consistent funding that allowed MMB and MNIT to regularly apply these release upgrades as they are pushed out. And periodically, in the case of a major release, have to have a supplemental budget to provide people to assist in a major upgrade. But to a large degree, the application of these upgrades to these critical systems should be a basic ongoing expense that we're providing adequate ongoing funding to, so that we don't every 5 years have a huge effort to just catch up on all of the patches that have been ignored.
Mr. Hall,
yeah, Mr. Chair, we couldn't agree more. I just want to accept some responsibility. We also need to dedicate the time and effort to create a funding plan that makes sense. I don't know that we've ever given you what I would feel is that I have a level of confidence in a long-term funding proposal, and that's why the request before you today is for one-time money. We need additional analysis to help us tell you what things should look like 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road. That was the conversation we had with the legislative auditor as they looked at just the systems funding component of our IT operation. And I think we're all in collective agreement about what the need is. I just hesitate to come to you with a request for a certain amount of money that I can't tell you with confidence really is going to get us to where you want us to be in 10 years. So we will bring that to you. I just don't think it's appropriate to bring it at a time if we can't tell you it's going to bring us over the finish line.
And then, Mr. Chair, just to follow up, just the other general point of concern was many of the agencies that use these systems are unclear about the basis for the chargebacks that they receive to use them, and that seems like something that could also use some analysis to come up with a more transparent chargeback mechanism that the client agencies would understand better.
Mr. Hallstrom.
Yes, Mr. Chair and representatives, I think that's accurate. I want to delineate a little bit between the minute chargeback model, which we have tried. Our budget team has been actively working with Minute to kind of refine that over time. But then also we have the capacity to assess agencies for statewide systems costs. That is currently an assessment of $10 million a year is what we're allowed to collect. that I think agencies understand the basis on which they are billed. It's number of users of a system, amount of transactions. But it is worth noting that we spend more than that $10 million chargeback in maintenance of the and administration of the system. So although we have there is a funding mechanism around chargebacks to state agencies for the enterprise IT systems at MMB, though that is not sufficient to actually pay for the ongoing cost. And so that's part of the challenge around long-term funding for the systems.
Yeah. And then last follow-up, Mr. Chair, is the agency going to be taking a position on whether these kinds of expenses should be funded through an allocation directly to MMB or done through chargebacks, given that the I think there's at this point probably widespread acknowledgement that the current mechanism really isn't completely funding the work that needs to be done.
Mr. Hallstrom.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. I think MMB is open to talking about a variety of models that make the most sense. I don't believe are wedded to any one particular approach. I don't, you know, the agency assessment isn't necessarily the best approach. It is an approach, and I think I don't want to speak for my colleagues at the Legislative Auditor's Office, but the expectation they offered up some they seemed agnostic as to what the particular approach the legislature chooses to take is, but rather, as long as it can show that it's going to meet the needs of the system, that's what's key. So there's a variety of ways to do that, and we would be more than happy to spend some time discussing some of those alternatives and the pros and cons of each.
Thank you. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, Mr. Hallstrom. You mentioned earlier in your testimony about the need to have to compete with the private sector. And this committee and other divisions continue to hear and have continued to hear for the last many years this ever-present claim that you have to compete with the private sector. And I would like to argue that the dynamics of working in government are quite different than working in the private sector. In the private sector, most of these competitive positions you're referring to are merit-based, and they're based on the ability of a leader or someone in an organization to create more lift than drag to the organization. And what I mean by that is simply that in the private sector, business, which employs people, needs to market, promulgate a lead, develop that lead into a sale, actually perform the work, do the work, pay the costs, the direct costs, the indirect costs, try to collect the money, and actually hope that there's something left over called profit. Now, usually this compensation is driven towards increasing market share within a competitive environment and creating growth for the company and opportunities for its employees. But in government, we don't have any of those dynamics, really. We have the power of levy. We just take whatever we need to make government work. That's what we do here. We raise revenue. We tax people. So I think the dynamic is really quite different. And given the fact that in Minnesota, the typical government job is compensating about 30% more than the private sector, that it is generally pretty stable when there's exacerbated market turndowns. I know that with greater income, there's a lot of stability in government in terms of its benefits and its pension plans. That's a trade-off. And yet, even yesterday, we're hearing arguments how we need to remove the salary caps for local government. It's just never ending. And so I really challenge you to explain to me why you feel it's so important or necessary to be competing. Yesterday when we heard about removing the salary caps, we're clearly talking about pretty high positions. And when I look at spreadsheets, whether it's this division or other ones, usually just in round numbers, not in every case, but it seems like when we're adding FTEs, whatever that number is, multiply that times $100,000, and that's the budget request. So, you know, the typical average Minnesotan makes about $58,000 a year. So those are my comments. How would you respond to the need to having to compete in the private sector and whether or not you really can have a qualified applicant apply for the job or not?
Mr. Hallstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the comments. In some respects, I don't know that I disagree. There in some cases are going to be very major differences between the kind of positions that we can offer, the kind of benefit packages that a public sector entity can offer, and that really becomes the crux of that. You know, when we talk about competing with the private sector, it's rarely going to be dollar to dollar wages. It has some of those intangible attributes that you discussed. Not to mention, many people want and value public service, and so there are people that want to work and delivering the types of services that Minnesota state government provides. I don't want to misrepresent either some of my testimony. One of our largest competitors are other public sector entities. So we do find ourselves in competition with the counties, municipalities throughout the state, not just the private sector. So, you know, when we look at our, you know, remaining competitive, we are looking at both in the state and regionally public sector entities. So we're looking at other state governments. We're looking at particularly the metro county areas where a lot of our state workforce works. And I working in an agency that is a central service agency, we do lose a lot of our employees to other state or other public sector employers in the state. Excuse me. I do want to emphasize that the state workforce is a merit-based system. We operate on merit-based principles, and so we hire the best for a position when we can. And I think that the pressures that face some of our classifications are very different agency to agency. The challenges we see around nursing, around correctional officers, and some of our hardest to fill positions, you know, are oftentimes unique to those types of positions. But we do have certain classifications where their primary competition is in the private sector. Nursing is a good example of that. We have other types of positions, such as law enforcement, that, you know, only competing really with other public sector entities. So I think it's a little difficult to paint in a large, broad brush, and that's sometimes what I have to do when I'm talking about the workforce as a whole. So I don't want to I don't want to misstate the unique pressures that particular agencies feel, but I also I think that it's fair to say that many of our employees are engaged in service delivery activities, whether they're at the Department of Revenue and they're supporting somebody who's trying to figure out how to file their taxes or address a complex question, whether they're at the Department of Human Rights or Department of Labor and Industry, where they're taking a complaint from somebody and that who wants investigated. So I think the most relevant model or most relevant comparator is probably service level work as opposed to maybe sales or other individuals in the private sector that maybe have responsibility for driving profits. In the service delivery model, it's usually finding efficiencies, process improvement, and finding better ways to deliver a service or meet the needs of your customers. So I think there are places where we're competing pretty directly with both private and public sector employers, and there's other positions that are certainly unique to the state government, and so we try to raise up the best parts of working for the state, and still the end goal for our perspective is to be an employer of choice, an employer that people want to come work for, and try to be a model employer in the state.
And Mr. Hallstrom, I know we heard the other night in transportation from the State Patrol that they're having issues with keeping people as troopers that they're leaving and going to work for other police departments after they spend a lot of money on training. We spend the money, they go away. We've heard that from the legislative auditor, that he gets people in, they get trained, and then they leave and go elsewhere and make a lot more money. And he's got an issue with, he's got people that are all brand new and people that have been there a long time and nobody in between. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that response, Mr. Hallstrom. In no way do I want to diminish the value of public service. That's not my intent here. However, that said, I mean, in some of the comments you made, it would appear that, you know, removing salary caps at the local level only exacerbates your problem in terms of having to compete with other local governments, as you had stated. And lastly, so many folks in the private sector really are at will servants to whatever they choose to do. And, you know, I think it's just fine that we have organized labor in state government and that there have been successful contracts, but there's a trade-off for that stability and that security and knowing that once you've made it past a certain benchmark that your job is pretty secure. And if part of what you claim is the compensation is necessary, looking for efficiencies, I haven't seen government becoming more efficient or the cost of it going down, not in my lifetime. And case in point, and I've said this in another committee, in my lifetime, going back to when I was a student, Minnesota was approaching $1 billion for a general fund budget. And today we're talking about nearly $50 billion. And even if you adjust for inflation, even if you adjust for the population growth in the state, government has grown since, and I'll give you the benchmark, 1970, government has grown nearly three times as fast as the private sector in that time in terms of as measured by dollars adjusted for population and for inflation. So I appreciate the work you're doing at MMB. The last question I wanted to ask with regard to all of the different respective accounts you have, what latitude do you have to move money around between the accounts within a biennium to solve any deficiencies that you have?
Mr. Hallstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I could. We have certain capacity in statute to make some adjustments, but I think I feel like I should maybe get a more precise question so that I hesitate to speak incorrectly or get out in front of my budget director if I am speaking about a particular fund. On balance, we have only the discretion that is provided by law, and so if there is, we have, for instance, I talked about this in the context of federal funding. If we have confidence or maybe a contract with a state in a federal grant provider, and so the only reason we're not receiving resources from them is because the agency that sends those resources is not up and operational. So we have a certain level of confidence that we're going to receive that reimbursement. There's authority to essentially cash flow, we sometimes use that term, cash flow the program to carry it through seamlessly until that reimbursement comes. Discretion requires a pretty heavy showing of a certainty. Otherwise it would be a risky endeavor. That's the one example I can think of right now. We have, if there's a particular kind of fund interaction, I can also chase down the answer to that, because I'm sure there are some particular instances where there is a little bit more flexibility. I just can't speak to them off the top of my head right now.
So, Mr. Hallstrom, some of it might be fair to say that some of that is depending on what latitude we as the legislature give you with the funds that you get.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Hallstrom.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner Hallstrom, my question is on the results first budget request. This seems like an incredibly important program to be making sure that we're improving results for Minnesotans and doing so in an efficient way. I'm curious about how the performance measures and priorities are set. Are they from requests from your agency partners? Are they requests from the legislature? How are you determining what you're focusing on?
Mr. Hallstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it depends. For the Pew and MacArthur program, there's actually a oversight committee that is comprised of local government leaders, legislators, and others that help kind of identify the topics where we think that there would be most it would be most advantageous to evaluate. I think we would probably the opioid program is a little bit more tailored, and so the evaluations there would be, you know, looking at where the funds are going and then trying to figure out the most valuable evaluations to drive some of that decision making. Usually it's a collaborative process is what I would say. Our results team are excellent facilitators, and one of the things that they're very good at is listening. And so they will usually bring stakeholders together and map out what they see as kind of common areas of agreement or need. They also, in general, do not do, they don't do research in the typical sense. They don't run like a double-blind study. Rather, they take the literature and the evidence that exists and try to align that with the programs that they're evaluating. So they can say that a particular program has promise but has not shown results. They might have another program that has results actually shown in other states or in other communities, state, local, tribal governments that have experimented with that in the past. Pull that together and try to give some information on what a return on investment is for every dollar spent. On this particular recidivism program, we know that we're saving, we're getting $250 back into the community and saving another dollar in government services down the line. So that's, I think I'm not as familiar with the opioid stewardship program's model for a selection, but I think the first of the two, the general fund request, would, there's lots of openings and opportunities, I think, for a variety of stakeholders to have an influence in what that looks like. And one of the tasks that they would be asked to do is to actually try to identify those measures that are most kind of cross-cutting and probably provide the most bang for their buck. They are a impressive and efficient group, and so I have a lot of faith in our director, Pete Bernardi, and his ability to pull together the right mix, but we would be open to discussions, too, about ways that we might be able to capture legislative goals around getting input into that process as well.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the metrics that have been looked at to date, do you know if those have been primarily implemented through the agencies, or have there been best practices or suggestions that have come back to the legislature as ways to improve operations?
Mr.
Also, Mr. Chairman, Representative Long, this year was the first year, I think, that the budget submissions from agencies tried to articulate as best they could kind of the results. You know, we're starting to be able to filter the work of the results program into the agency requests. So we've been able to identify, evidence-based interventions or programs that, hopefully will bring them up in front in the governor and the legislature's eyes and make them worthy of the resources that we're asking for. I'm most familiar with the work that the group has done around early education and recidivism, but I know that there's a great deal of work that's been done around community children's mental health. And that is primarily driven by, there's a lot of county activity in that space. And so kind of depending on the program area, the agency, you're going to see a different mix of participants and a different mix of stakeholders. Excuse me. And so as we, you know, when if we're looking at recidivism, you're talking about counties, you're talking about the Department of Corrections. We've looked at transportation, particularly metro mobility, and how to, you know, approaches to addressing some of the costs and the needs there. So I think maybe we could do a little bit more to fill you in on and get you some background on the work. I know that our team is always looking for an opportunity to share the work that they've done, and they would be able to probably answer some of your more specific and particular questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last question. So the 2.5 FTE increase request seems pretty modest for trying to have a big impact on effective government. I'm curious, what are you seeing as the demand for services, and what do you view as some of the ways that those employees could help meet some of the metric work that you're doing?
Mr. Hallstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Long. You know, there is generally an excess of requests for their expertise than they're able to provide, but they've been able to obtain some grant funding to kind of to support their work. As I mentioned, the Pew MacArthur aspect of the Results First program brings in additional resources and support from others, from both the state of Washington and then from kind of the Washington, D.C. national leadership. We could take 10 people and probably still fill adequately their days with work for agencies that are looking for this kind of expertise and assistance. I think what we try to focus on are places where we at an enterprise level can bring the most value for that analysis. There are lots of agencies that have program evaluators and the capacity to evaluate particular programs that they might have. But when you're looking at the entirety of a budget or entirety of a subject matter area, it's important to kind of bring in all those players. So you might have 4, 5, 6 agencies at the table, along with a lot of county representation and maybe city municipal representation as well. So I think I would say that we focus our efforts on those things where we're going to bring the most value, having that enterprise focus, and not get in the way of agencies that are able to manage a program evaluation kind of for a particular need area.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Commissioner. As a freshman, I continue to be impressed by all the great work that we do here at the state. And so I had a question about your the impact evaluation of the opioid stewardship investments. And my question is really in reference to, why are you waiting with the epidemic such as it is, why are we waiting until 2021 to do this when it's of such importance now?
Mr. Hallstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I think the thinking was that we wanted to, that our team wanted some experience to react to. This is essentially an evaluation of the expenditure of state funds. Mm-hmm. And so the thinking behind the proposal in the opioid stewardship legislation is that as we invest those resources and substantial resources into these interventions, that we should be kind of correspondingly tracking the outcomes. That I don't mean to say that we don't probably have a library of evidence and indicators to date, or that the Department of Health or Department of Human Services doesn't already know with some level of confidence types of interventions that are successful, but this would actually be tracking the actual outcomes of the money that we're putting into the program as part of this package. So I think that the thinking was wait to have some experience with which to work.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think in regards to the troopers, part of the issue is that over the last several budgets, because we had billion-dollar deficits instead of the surplus, they've been either little or no increase. and so their pay hasn't been keeping up with other law enforcement entities. Also, when we look at these members, we look through here and we see the FTE, and if you look in the minute, oftentimes it'll be $200,000 or $250,000 per FTE. I do project program management, and when I size resources, it's not just the actual salary, but and there's benefits, but the benefits tend to be about the same across. But there's support staff, equipment, software, and office space. And so for some of the, especially IT, if they need to have seats on several platforms, there's costs there that can be substantial. So it's good that we're looking at that, but sometimes specifics vary. I'm a little bit perplexed in the line of questioning that came up earlier in regards to Oracle and upgrades and et cetera. I heard something that there were things that were skipped in 12-13, which means that actually legislature in 11 and 12 would be looking at, and that predates where Minute would have been involved in this whole discussion. I'd like to have the committee enlightened on who is making the decision to skip or bypass it. And I was on a school board. We had to look at deferring maintenance. So, I understand that you make those decisions. But when coming to the legislature, at least in the terms that I've been on this committee, I'm not hearing a lot of, we need, these upgrades, so it's going to be X amount of money. So if it's been going on for 8 years, I assume that the initial determinations were made by personnel within. And when did it shift to Minute driving this, or is it still independent and MMB is personnel are making the decisions?
Mr. Hallstrom, and I believe some of those things as far as upgrades, and if I remember right, the discussion about creating Minute was there was such a wide spread in all the departments because there were so many different people, but that was part of the reasoning for creating Minute. Some may argue one way or the other that was a good or a bad idea, but I think that was, if I remember the arguments, that was some of the reasonings for doing it. But Mr. Hallstrom.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Plum. Ownership of those decisions rests with MMB. It's not their responsibility to make an ultimate decision at an agency level about when to defer maintenance and what to ask for. The decisions are the post-launch of Swift. Swift being our largest and kind of most expensive Oracle system. And probably the highest profile used by the most employees beyond our time and attendance system. It was a big endeavor when we moved from the previous accounting program, some may remember the acronym MAPS is what it was called, and moved to Swift. I honestly was before my time, not long before my time, but before my time at MMB, and I believe that when you the legislature appropriated about, I'm going to, please don't hold me to this number, but I think about $65 million. I'm getting a thumbs up from the audience, so I think that's the number. That the system launch, that's a substantial investment, and I'm going to guess that for the next couple years it was challenged to come forward and ask for a lot of additional resources to continue to work on that. I think that it's a problem that all agencies struggle with. You need to maybe do an upgrade or to purchase a system, and you feel lucky if you can get the necessary resources to do that, and you don't necessarily, if you're not provided with an ongoing maintenance or support account, sometimes you might say, well, I'm better off
getting at least the fix. I sometimes use the example of, you know, you get a new vehicle, and then you have to figure out how we're going to go about doing my regular maintenance. Are we going to, you know, take it to the dealer? Are you going to take it to the discount oil change place? Are you going to do it yourself? And those are the questions that agencies struggle with when it comes to ongoing maintenance. We just know that over time, we have not been able to keep up with the pace of those upgrades and patches as they're coming through. And the problem is, as that pacing continues and we continue to move at a slower pace in terms of upgrades, I don't mean to suggest that we haven't taken any patches. As cybersecurity fixes come in, we've been able to take some of the ones that are most pressing, accessibility improvements for our software. But at some point, if we're not keeping up, as we fall behind, we are hitting a point where we're not going to be able to take any of the future upgrades. And so that is kind of, Swift is the example I use, but this is a problem that faces a lot of our software that is provided by external vendors. And that's one of the reasons motivating our decision recently, as our BPaaS or the budget system was something we chose to build internally, so we had a little bit more control over kind of the pace around those upgrades and not being driven entirely by an external vendor who says, well, we're going to make this move, and if you don't come with us, then you're going to be out of support. So it's a difficult relationship with our vendor. They would rather we spend more money on ongoing maintenance and investments, and we have to figure out the best allocation of those resources. But I think long term, we need to do a better job of predicting and giving you all the information that we understand about what the real costs are of that ongoing maintenance work, so that we are presenting when we obtain a new system or when we obtain funding from the legislature, we're able to keep it at a level of support and that meets everybody's expectations. I just don't think that we've done a good enough job of being able to take that long view. And that's what we hope to improve on and kind of bring before this committee in the future.
Representative Qualm, and if you, Mr. Hallstrom, we're getting late, and I've got four more people on the list here, and if you can keep your answers a little shorter, I know.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
Representative Qualm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I do concur with your statements about Minute and things that went into that debate. I'm a little bit disconcerted, and I just heard we were able to take some of the security updates. That's very disconcerting. The other thing that's disconcerting is, it's like you're on a school board and you're going to build a new building, but you didn't put the money in for desks and chairs. But when we have agencies come before us asking for, we want the real story and the full story, and to buy this is cost X amount, but everybody knows that you get oil changes on your car because you used automotive, and there's ongoing costs, and it's just not just prudent, it's just reasonable to expect agencies would have this as our annual burn for maintaining what we have. And I would hope that the chair would try to make sure that what we've received in this book includes the appropriate, so that we don't have things breaking because you're not doing the normal stuff. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Qualm, as he was speaking and talking about it, I also thought about the backlog we have of deferred maintenance on multiple buildings throughout the state, and the discussion we hear from the transportation department of the backlog of repairs and maintenance that we have on our highways, that we spend the money on the bright shiny new and forget about the routine maintenance, because no one does a ribbon cutting when you replace the roof on a building. But they're all doing the ribbon cutting when we build the brand new building, because that's the shiny new object. So that's something that we as legislators need to think about always, and I think it's something we need to think about as we move along.
Mr. Chair, that's a great point, and I think that's why we have a diverse group of backgrounds sitting on this committee, so we can bring forward the perspectives that maybe we can avoid missing things.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a number of questions, but they're questions, so I'll just fire off questions if that's okay, and we'll keep it as short as we can. So a first question to the testifier is, we talked a little bit about gain share. Are all the policies and procedures now consistent with the statute?
Mr. Hallstrom.
Mr. Chair, no. I think the short answer to that is we still continue to struggle with both the funding side of things, but the challenges that we have in the law. So, you know, we continue to work on that and ready to engage.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Second question. Are any payments now being made under the gain share program?
Representative Mr. Hallstrom.
Mr. Chair and Representative Vogel, no.
That's good.
Representative Vogel.
Have the mandated, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, have the mandated reports as were done in 2007 statute been made twice a year?
Mr. Hallstrom.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vogel, we've submitted several reports. I'm not sure what the where we're at on the calendar. The statute, I think, says biannual. I'm not entirely sure. There's not a strict calendar there, but I, like I said, I have one on my desk as we speak.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it was in the legislation in 2017 there was going to be biannual reports. And the fourth question was, so then are all of the things that needed to be done to comply with the statute done? I'm assuming from the answer that question may be, or the answer may be no, but that is the question.
Mr. Hallstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, you're correct.
Okay.
Representative Vogel.
So, Mr. Chair, the reason I'm asking this is because, and we talked a little bit about compensation. I'm assuming that when we look at this and we see 257.95 employee FTEs and 28,736, and I got my decimal right, it's not billion today. That comes out.
I said the other day, I make the same mistake often.
So it comes out to about 111,000 or 112,000 per year per FTE. Would that be correct,
Mr. Hallstrom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel. I mean, it's each position has a number associated with it, and then a fringe. There's, I think, Representative Quam alluded to some back of the envelope. You know, way you can do that is around 100,000. Your number doesn't make me think that it's wrong.
Okay. And thank you, Mr. Chair. Just going from FTEs to the total compensation. So, and we also talked a little bit about troopers. And I'm guessing relative to their compensation, if you guessed $80,000 to $85,000 a year for total compensation, may not be too far away. And the reason I bring this point up is that, you know, we're looking at spending, not investing, but we spent the money. $3,766,000 per year on this new endeavor. Now, we've got an endeavor that's been here since 2012 that's not fully implemented, that went through an OLA audit, that still isn't compliant with statute. So for us to assume that anything is going to be enacted and actually followed by statute at this point is a little bit suspect in my mind. The reason I bring this up is because if we're going to spend the $3,766,000, even at that $111,000 a year, comes out to 33 FTEs. If you drop it down to 85, which is closer to a trooper, we're maybe about 45 FTEs. So as we move into this, my big thing is accountability. If we're going to spend $7 million over the course of a biennium on a program that's supposed to bring better employees and more efficiency, just like Gainshare, and we're going to treat it with the same statutory respect in MMB that they've had for Gainshare, I suggest that $7 million may not be well spent. Thank you.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of following up on comments by Representative Quam and Hertaz as well, I think it's kind of dangerous to generalize about comparing salaries in the private sector and in the public sector. number just cited by Representative Vogel, say that the internal chargeback rate for IT resources fully loaded at Optum was over $120 an hour. And in my, you know, conversations with various stakeholders, you know, related to MNIT work, there seems to be a fairly general consensus that, you know, at the lower levels of the pay grades, where the developers, business analysts, and whatnot, that our rates are generally relatively competitive. But at the upper levels, where the salaries for like the assistant commissioner level, approximately, because we have had this idea going back to I don't know how long that nobody's supposed to make more than the governor, the wage rates, salary rates at those levels are severely squeezed. And the problem is that it's at those decisions, that dunderheaded design decisions, such as the that you should identify a vehicle in Minlars using the license plate, get made. And those are the kinds of mistakes that drive tens of millions of dollars of expenses in a project like that. I think it would be worthwhile, actually, to commission a study of, you know, what is the comparison actually between private sector wages and public sector wages at these kind of director, assistant commissioner levels, because, well, this relates to another conversation that I had with Representative Nash early on. We were speculating together about, you know, what kind of a person would be both qualified and willing to take on the job of MNIT commissioner. And we both had thought about it and independently come to the same conclusion, is that the only person who would be, type of person who would be both willing to take the job and qualified to do it, would be a CEO or CIO at a company who was nearing retirement, had already earned more money than God, and would want to do it for the same reason that we take, you know, two-thirds pay cuts to be here, is that we want to make, we don't need any more money, and we want to, you know, do something to work the make the world a better place, and think we have something unique to contribute to it. And we had both independently come to the same conclusion, and both of us had told Peggy Flanagan exactly that.
And, Representative Elkins, I know they do occasionally do wage studies. I don't know when the last one was done of all employees. I think we could get copies of that, and maybe even the legislative auditor has a report on that. But Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm kind of, well, Mr. Hallstrom, do you know what the mean wage or the average wage of a service line worker for you is?
Mr. Hallstrom.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think it would be hard to generalize. We have a pretty wide variety from, you know, executive budget officers to labor relations coordinators to statewide accounting service teams. So I think I don't have an average number for a line service person in our agency, and I know that they are very different at other agencies as well.
Right, and it's always, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, it's always good to talk about the upper-level jobs, but most of us around this table know who actually does the work. And it's really amazing that we're bringing this up, because I, as a realtor, I look at a source called Living Wage, and in Minnesota it costs $25 to $30 an hour to have a family of four to actually, that's live in a house, decent, not a decent house, but a house, and drive to work every day and feed your family, but that's no cabin, that's the stay vacations and stuff like that. And I believe that many of our state workers are in that situation. And I can see it used to be a real easy job to recruit state workers, but it's not anymore. It's unstable. They don't know what the legislator's going to do. They could be out of a job. I mean, I'm a state worker for the first time. I might be out of a job in 2 years. We'll see. But, you know, and Mr. Chair, Representative Hertas, it was interesting that you brought up the 70s, because the first time our budget hit $1 billion was under Governor Anderson, and it cost $25,000 to build a house then. It's a different time, because now we're looking at around $300,000.
Adjusted for inflation and population.
Right, and so we're in a different time. And like I said, I don't think that I empathize with the Deputy Commissioner here to I think you are having a hard time, and I can feel that. And I think we as the legislators have to do what we can to assist you, because you are competing in a hard market, and people just don't want to come anymore. I get that. So thank you for your testimony today.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hallstrom, I'm of the opinion that our state agencies owe it to Minnesotans to hire the best and the brightest. But in order to do that, we need to compensate those individuals. So MMB is in a unique situation. Just I'm taking a step back and looking at the agency profile and your purpose. Mission is to manage the state's financial workforce, information resources, support effective and efficient services for all Minnesotans. So you're the central service agency. You mentioned several times through your testimony of this enterprise focus. So with 55,000 state employees, how do you take the temperature of those 55,000 individuals? We know people are motivated by different things, be it compensation, be it purpose in their work in terms of giving back to their community. This sense of job satisfaction, right? What gets your people excited to get up and go to work every day? Do you have a sense of that?
Mr. Hallstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I think it's a great question. In fact, we are moving to implement an enterprise-wide engagement survey with our employees. Many agencies have kind of done this on their own, but we haven't really been able to compare and find those places where across state government where employees are feeling engaged, where they're feeling that job satisfaction. I know many, we've in our own strategic planning activity at MMB, I get feedback from our employees. We know that sometimes employees like to see promotional opportunities, trying to find some opportunities that allow mobility assignments to get people new experience and let them move from one agency to another without necessarily giving up their current job. Develop some of those, that cross-training capacity. But I think for a lot of state employees, the interest is in making Minnesota work better. And so that may, you may do that as an epidemiologist. You may do that as a plow driver. You may do it as a law enforcement officer. You may do it as a nurse. So, I mean, there are enough career families, and this is, in fact, one of our sales pitches to employees to come join the state, is that we can provide a variety and kind of the whole universe of job classifications here. So if you want to start in one type of position and develop into something else, that's something that you have going for you. We will have, though, enterprise engagement results that I think will help give us a lot of information about what is motivating our employees and where they're satisfied and where they're not. And then just to address a couple of the comments earlier, one of our requests in our workforce initiatives is for a wage study that will help us understand where we sit in comparison to our competitors. And I think combined, but employee engagement and wage data will help us, I think, have a better understanding of what we need to do to be good stewards of our employees.
Well, thank you.
Mr. Chair, a quick follow-up.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Holstrom, I appreciate that. I'm sure this committee would be interested in seeing those results. Just a real quick piece, though, on that. It's not a one-and-done. Obviously, with those types of surveys, I would encourage you to do that on an ongoing basis so that trends can be developed, so that you, by looking at that data, those improvements can be made. I think it's good to have a sustained effort in that and would be much looking forward to seeing how that improves over time.
Absolutely. Mr. Hallstrom. Okay. Okay.
The binders, do the staff want to take these back to add to them, or can we do?
You're anticipating what I was just going to say. Members, Tuesday we're going to have admin here. If you want to take the books with you so you can study them, this information's all online. So if you want to do it on the online, you can do that. Although I find it easier to make notes on paper than on my computer screen. But if you take them with you, make sure you bring them back here. Otherwise, the staff will take them and we'll have them here for our meetings. So,
we're dinosaurs.
Some of us are dinosaurs, yes. At least it's not the 2x4 that I'm writing in on a handy. Anyway, members, if there are any other questions, we're adjourned for today.